This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lakeside is on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here. Lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the daylight there. Gaining on the daylight.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42. Five. Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
Welcome back, podcast listeners. It's great to have you back with us, tuning in for part two of our look at the world of coaching. If you haven't already listened to part one, then it's definitely worth checking that out. But with four interviews this month from four very different characters from the world of sailing, it won't hurt to listen to this part first. But do go back and give part one a listen, though. It's fascinating. Before we get started, if you're enjoying what you hear, then head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. It's easy to use, and your support allows us to stay ad-free and to keep on delivering these uninterrupted pods. A huge thanks to all of you that have taken the time to support us. It's much appreciated. Thank you. In this edition, we talk to two very different characters from the coaching world. We finish our set of interviews with Dutch organisational psychologist Anja Marike van Bokstel, a very well-respected business coach that has applied her methodology to the sport of offshore sailing with great results. She's not a sailor herself, which allows her a fascinating approach towards running a happy, efficient team campaigning through the relentlessness of the grueling Volvo Ocean Race. But before that, almost at the very other end of the sailing spectrum, we talked to the man who coached Hannah Mills to her third consecutive Olympic medal, British double Olympic silver medalist Joe Glanfield. I hope you enjoy the time I spent with the sport of sailing super coaches.
You're trying to bring a performance together for a given week in 4 years. You can't control the result. You can only control the process that you go under. Your job doesn't stop when they sail away from you. You have to watch carefully.
To introduce our next guest, I'm going to take you back to 2016. The Rio Olympics, the final fleet race of the women's 470 class. Brits Hannah Mills and Saskia Clark crossed the finish line of their final fleet race on a race course deep in the depths of Guanabara Bay, having sailed themselves to a certain gold medal. Before any interview and congratulations, any celebrating, there was only one place they wanted to be, and that was on the coach boat with longtime coach Joe Glanfield. He was wearing a smile as broad as can be, and only then did the celebrating start. A quick glance at Joe's Olympic records tells quite a story. Athens, he won silver in the 470 with Nick Rogers. Beijing, he did it again. London, he coached Mills and Clark to silver, and then that gold in Rio. And just a few months ago, another gold for Mills, this time sailing with Ailie McIntyre, cementing Mills' title as the most successful female Olympic sailor ever. And for Glanfield, that's a medal a games since 2004. That's 20 years of campaigning, first as a sailor, then as a coach, with an Olympic podium finish every time. That's quite a record. We interviewed Joe at British Sailing's HQ down in Weymouth, where I kicked things off by asking Joe just what the gold for Mills and McIntyre meant to him personally.
It meant a huge amount to me. I mean, I think that last day I saw you, I just felt unbelievable relief that it was done, that they had achieved what I knew they could achieve. Obviously, been a hugely unusual build-up with COVID and things, but that week they sailed so well. It was such a controlled performance, and you know, it was amazing to be able to be part of that and just sit and watch them do that, and watch them from day one until the medal race just execute such a good performance.
Well, you're no stranger to the Olympic podium, of course, Joe. Two silver medals in the 470 with Nick Rogers. You yourself were coached by one of the real standouts of coaching, weren't you? Hamish Wilcox. Hamish has now been coaching Pete and Blair, not just in the 49er, but also at the America's Cup. So from a coaching perspective, as an athlete, you were in pretty good hands.
Yeah, definitely. Hamish was, I think, really sort of role modelled coaching to me and what it could offer. And, you know, he was hugely pivotal in my own sailing. And those, he coached me at all three Olympics from the age of 18. So he was a big influence on my life. And it, he really made me realise that not only can a coach offer you a lot technically, but also just your own support and development as a person.
Interesting. I mean, we're talking to coaches throughout this podcast, but let's just stay with that perspective for a minute and talk as an athlete at, say, an Olympic level. How important a role does a good coach play?
I think a good coach can do a lot. I think, I think different people would have different perspectives on that. But really, I think what a coach can be quite different to different people. So part of the skill of a coach is understanding what does this individual need from me? Who do they need me to be? And that adaptation, I think, is really important. But certainly, if you think about it with Olympic sailing, you're trying to bring a performance together for a given week in 4 years. So it's a very strategic project. And so I think to have someone sat outside of the boat helping you with that can be really important.
What do you think you learned from Hamish? Are there ways of coaching that have made it down through to your coaching style?
Yeah, I think what did I learn from Hamish? I think in terms of coaching, I think he had a great balance between informality and formality, and when actually, although, you know, when you're on the road together, you tend towards a sort of quite informal relationship, but actually knowing when you needed to sit down and discuss something and discuss it in a bit of detail, and you needed to be happy to disagree about it and work through those disagreements rather than avoid them in the first place. From a more of a sailing specific angle of what I learned from Hamish, I guess I learned a lot about technique, and I learned a lot about looking at technique in detail and being able to make that technique really accessible even when you're under a lot of stress and really adaptable to conditions.
What kind of coach was Hamish?
He was supportive, and I would have said Hamish was very inspiring. He really made me want to win, and he really made me want to get better.
Do you think a good coach has to have excelled as an athlete?
No, I don't. I think there's other things that are more important. I think for those that haven't got either experience in the sport or done the sport to a high level, the battle they have to get through is credibility with the people they're coaching. But I think you can get through that by the way that you work with them. Whilst perhaps rightly or wrongly, I think sometimes having done well yourself gives you that credibility. But it can also be a problem because the starting point is that they look to you for the answer because you've done it before. When actually what you want, where you want to get to is where you're empowering them for what do they think. And then you're just working with them to find the right answers.
Joe, can you describe your own coaching style?
I can try. I suppose I would sort of put it as being athlete-centred. So as in, I need to really understand who they are, what their challenges are, what their strengths are, what their beliefs are, you know, and why they're doing it. And also sort of project-centred. So as in, what are we trying to achieve and by when? And really understanding that before trying to think who I need to be in my role. And who they need me to be. And then I suppose more generally, I think all coaching is sort of made up of this combination of support and challenge, and how much we and when do we need to really support the people we're coaching? When do we need to really challenge them and make them look at what they're doing and how they could do it better? And then all coaching ultimately is about communication, and it's about communicating really well with those people and having difficult conversations with them and solving problems together. And so, is that a coaching philosophy? I'm not sure, but that I would say they're very much at the centre of who I am as a coach.
It's such a close relationship, isn't it? I mean, particularly when you're dealing with one or two athletes, you become so tight, such a unit.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you need to. And I think they need to know that you care about them and that you care about what they're trying to do, that you're as invested in that as they are. And that also means when you challenge them and when you ask them difficult questions and really make them look at themselves, they know it comes from a good place, and they know it's not your ego or that you're trying to sort of put them down. It really is that you want to find the answer and you want to help them get better.
I've always found when Hannah's won, you're nowhere to be seen. Does it feel a bit odd that your job's kind of done?
Yeah, a little bit. I suppose I do have going back to coaching philosophy, I think it's about the athlete and it's not about you as a coach. And I'm very conscious of that, and it feels slightly strange doing an interview here about coaching, because I generally shy away from doing interviews because I want it to be, it is about the sailors. They're the ones that are doing it and they're the ones that have to go and perform. So I do always tend to shy away a bit.
Let's talk specifics with Hannah. Hannah Mills, of course, recently crowned with partner Ailey McIntyre Women's World Sailor of the Year. And Hannah is a very accomplished sailor in her own right, driven, I mean, from a very early age, talented. But it's well documented in sport, with the wrong approach, you can actually sort of coach the talent out of an athlete, can't you? What's your approach been with Hannah?
Hannah I've known for a very long time. I think I first coached her when she was in 420s. So that helps a lot, you know, is that actually we got that history together, and she knows me well. My approach with Hannah, I guess, as you say, she's a fantastic talent. Really astute about what's important, what she needs to work on. So a lot of my role really has been to not overcoach her, to not say, this is how I did it, so this is how you should do it, but actually challenge her to be better than I was at anything, really, which she's managed to do. But also, I suppose, just to keep holding the mirror up to her when she about what she said she intended to do and what she wanted to do and how she's going to do that, and make sure she's staying true to that. And then I think alongside that, much more sailing specific, we race in slightly different ways. And I think when we have those pre-race conversations, she's able to discuss my perspective as well as her perspective, but because she's quite a strong person, she won't let that overly influence her. So we come up with a good combination from that point of view.
You used the phrase holding the mirror up to her, talking about Hannah. I mean, sailing a really technical sport, but you're not just a sailing coach. There's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, I think there is, yeah, because you're right, it's a very technical sport and some of your coaching has to be on that technical side. But we're very much in a development game, and what I mean by that is even the most talented sailors, like Hannah, they get to a point and they get a bit stuck. And so actually to find those answers in yourself of what do I struggle with, how do I develop, how do I improve, you need to find those answers, and that often is where they need the most help in finding those answers. We've all seen people at Olympic level get to a really high level quite quickly and then just get stuck, and stuck for years. You know, like actually they will hang around between 5th and 10th in the world where they got to by the age of 21 for the whole of their 20s, you know, without finding the answer to get to do that last bit. And that, so that is difficult. And I think that is beyond just the technical gains. That is understanding yourself and understanding how you learn.
I'm often asked about coaching women and if that's different. And it's been well documented, isn't it? I remember, you know, in British hockey, they talked about coaching women and how to get the best out of them, you need a slightly different approach. They want to know why. What have you found in your experience?
I suppose I'd be reluctant to comment too much about that because I've been lucky enough to coach individuals. So you then quite quickly look at the individual. So for instance, coaching Hannah Mills is different to coaching Saskia Clark or coaching Ailey McIntyre, you know, because they're different individuals. They're all women, but they are different. And likewise, that would then be different to coaching Nathan Outeridge or someone like that. And so I don't go too far down that road. I think what sometimes people do say, and you can see, is that for men, often ego will get in the way of their learning and their development. And I think that's less of a problem coaching women, is that actually you don't have blocks to conversations because of their egos getting in the way. But perhaps it's more likely that dips in confidence will get in the way. But overall, I would tend to think what coaching any individual is a different experience because that individual brings something different, and that's where my focus would be.
Hannah won Golden Reel with longtime crew Saskia Clark, and you coached them as well, of course. Then Saskia retired from Olympic sailing. How do you go about changing a combination that's been so successful and bring in someone else, presumably with their own skills, their own good points, their own weaknesses? How do you approach a big crew change like that?
Well, interestingly, and this has probably been an interesting part of Hannah and my journey together, is that we've had breaks from each other, which probably should help to not get sick of me. But, you know, I've gone and done other things, which has been important for me, taking new ideas, and she's had other inputs of coaches. And actually, when she first started coaching with when she started sailing with Ailey, her coach was a guy called Elliot Willis. So actually, in some respects, he handled the early stage of that transition more. But I think for me, in that final 2 years building up to this Olympics, I think the critical thing is Ailey and Han need to believe that they're creating their own identity, not trying to copy that of Hannah and Sasser's. And actually, Ailey would bring different things to that boat, and that would have an influence on what Hannah need to also bring to that boat. And I think that was quite an open subject. It was something we often talked about, and talked about the fact they're not trying to achieve the same thing. They're trying to achieve a gold medal in Tokyo as Hannah and Ailey, which is different to a gold medal in Rio as Hannah and Sass. So framing it like that then makes it feel like a new project with new opportunities and different constraints, and so then you can approach it in quite a fresh way.
A lot of expectation on Ailey McIntyre, though, first time Olympics.
Yes, so much.
How do you create that environment that she can actually flourish?
Yeah, there was so much expectation on Ailey, you know, and that the fact that Hannah was already a gold medalist, the fact that actually I've been their coach, I actually worried created more expectation because of the risk that she would look at herself as being the only thing that's changed since Rio. And she did amazingly well with that. You know, she really did thrive at that Olympics and really bring her best. And I think how we did that is again, it's going back, really going back to who she is and what does a good performance from her look like. And her really, firstly, understanding that, but being really driven by that. So I suppose what I mean by that is rather than being driven by the gold medal, being really clear on what a good performance looks like from her and being really driven by that to deliver that at the Olympics.
So you're coaching two people, they're sailing a 470. What's the most important thing, the biggest thing to work on to ensure success at the right time on the race course?
So I think in a 470 it might be different in other boats, but I don't think it's too different from my experience. It's really them understanding their roles at every point and understanding who's doing what and what needs to be communicated between them, and we fight for that alignment the whole way around the race course, essentially. You know, that like, actually, things in sailing, as you know, are always changing, and actually to know through every change, whether that's decision making, whether that's a maneuver, whether that's a transition through a gust or lull, who does what and when, and making sure it's really sort of succinct with each other. I think that ultimately is what you're trying to do. If you think of every point of the race course, it's a very complex interaction between two people. None more so perhaps than the start, you know, and what goes into executing a good start. And so that takes a lot of practice, like just hours, but it also takes a lot of discussion and finding the ability to put words onto things so they can be quickly communicated and adapted in the moment.
Like what? Give us an example.
Perhaps you've got a certain mode that you need to sail, and you can to make sure you know what that mode is, you might call it a certain thing that you can then so you can say, oh, we need to sail more like this, like freer or something, and actually both people know what their role is in sailing the boat freer. Or even you could say it about a condition, you know, like actually we think it's quite bandy now, that the wind, and they both know what that means and what that's likely to mean to their decision making.
Joe, you've obviously spent time at regattas. You see other setups, talk to other teams. Is everyone doing the same thing coaching wise, or is there a big difference between people's approaches and techniques?
I don't know, actually. I think sailing's gone through a transition, probably not sailing, actually, probably all coaching in sport, where there used to be very much an expectation that a coach would stand in front of the sailor and tell them what they need to do and how they should do it. And I think it's transitioned out of that, where it's more discussion, more asking the right questions, more challenging them according to what they said they should do and how they do it. And I think you probably, if you could take a spectrum across the different teams, different countries and different teams would fall in different places on that spectrum between the whole tell or ask and find out. And actually, I think every coach should move up and down that spectrum anyway. There's a certain time where actually you do just need to tell your sailor something, you know, because you saw it and they didn't, or you have an opinion. But it's how much time you spend at one end of the spectrum or the other, and in what context. And I think that's where there'd be a big variety.
If you look at the 470 class, I wanted to talk about Victor briefly, Joe. I mean, just quickly for our listeners, since the mid-80s, Victor Kovalenko has been coaching 470 sailing, most successfully for the Australian team. His nickname for years, still is, has been the Medalmaker. He's twice coached Australians to 470 men's and women's gold medals in a single games, and has a coaching relationship with the dominant Matt Belcher that goes back decades. I wanted to ask you, Joe, what is it about Victor's coaching that's made him so successful? Is there anything you see from the outside that gives you a glimpse of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely saying this from the outside, because obviously I haven't ever been coached by Victor, but I have now known him for a very, very long time. I suppose one thing you do see with Victor, I think there's a lot of differences to how I coach, and I've often thought about those differences, because I thought, should there be so many differences, because he's been so successful? But he's he's very hardworking, and he manages to get his sailors to be very hardworking in terms of sheer volume of sailing that they manage to do. And that sounds easy, but we all know with sailing, it has to be, when you put hours in on the water, they have to be focused, they have to be 100%. So he's obviously very good at motivating people to do that time, even when they're already the best in the world, to still put in the hours 100% to keep on pushing on. And that's quite a hard skill. That's quite to motivate people to do that and feel the value in doing that. I think he'd probably also got a very clear methodology, which I think you see a lot with a lot of the top coaches. You know, he has a belief of this is what we need to do to be successful, and that guides him in what he does. So it's not random in any way. You know, it's strategic in its approach, and I imagine that's very much at the heart of what Victor does and what has been amazingly successful over a very long period of time.
Having said all that about Victor, Jill Glanfield, 3 Olympics in a coach boat, 2 golds and a silver. I mean, you've coached Hannah Mills to the most successful female Olympic sailor of all time. It's a pretty impressive record.
Yeah. I mean, I've been really lucky to be involved with Hannah and Ailey and Hannah and Sass. You know, they're all very good sailors, very committed to what they're doing, and really enjoyable to coach and be on that journey with. We definitely had hard days, but equally, you know, it was hugely rewarding, but particularly Rio and Tokyo, and to see them win. You know, and I actually didn't expect that. I didn't expect it to be as rewarding as it was. You know, I'm definitely a small part of what they achieved, but only a small part. But even with that, it was, you know, just to see them on the podium and know you had some small part in that was hugely rewarding.
How hard is this aspect of the job, Joe? We see all you coaches out in the coach boats during racing, mostly all alone. It's tough. I mean, you've no control once your team leave you for a race. It's out of your hands. Give us a glimpse of what's that like, sending them off, and what can be an all or nothing day of racing.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely stressful, and it's definitely, I find it more stressful than actually doing yourself. But you know, in the same breath, I think if you feel like you've prepared in a way that where they're non-dependent on you, you know, that actually all you've done is sort of prime them to be, help them look at the right things and think about that race in the right way, then I feel like you can relax and let go a bit, let go of that control. And I think that's important with coaching, is you can't control the result. You can only control to a certain extent the process that you go under, and that's more what I judge myself on, whether they actually win or not. But I mean, some of those races in both all of the Olympics I've coached at, actually you can barely watch, you know, out of anxiety and stress. But I think that probably is an important point, is, you know, the fact that we can watch and we can watch from the edge of the course, it becomes really important. Your job doesn't stop when they sail away from you. You have to watch carefully, and you have to watch them carefully, and you have to watch the race carefully, to then be in a really good position to question the right moments in the race, to identify what they did well or didn't do well. And then you can direct that discussion a little bit, because it's only a short discussion before the next race. So your job never stops in that sense.
When Ian Walker coached me back in the day, the coaches were restrained in a sort of pen, and he would just drive back and forward like he was pacing the room.
I can really imagine Ian doing that as well.
It's a nervous time.
Yeah, it is. But and you can see everyone else is in the same place. All the other coaches are looking as anxious as you are.
So you've also been coaching on the Sail GP circuit. Tell us a little bit about that, how you approach that, and how different that is. A big team, a big budget, big personalities?
Yeah, it's really different. So the first thing is obviously the team size is different. The boats are completely different. You also have this incredible access to data and video, which you don't have so much within the Olympic world. And then the whole format of the racing is different as well. You know, you get very little training time, really quick turnaround between races. But it's just, it's really interesting, and it's been so valuable also for my Olympic coaching. You know, that has been a huge opportunity. But both ways, I think the Olympic coaching set me up well with that. But, essentially, if you go back to that being athlete-centred and project-centred and thinking, okay, who are the people involved? What is the project of being successful in this? Then you start to think what I need to be as a coach is slightly different to what I need to be as a Olympic coach. All the sailors I coach in the CIGP know more about the boats than I do. Whilst 470s, I've sort of been surrounded by them forever and know similar amounts. But then they need more facilitation because it's a bigger group. So actually there's a big role there in terms of literally just facilitating a conversation. And whilst, with Hannah and Ailey, it's just three of us sat in a room, so that's got a different feel to it as well. But it's really good to have these different experiences. I did think to myself at one point last year, I'm coaching Hannah Mills, Ailey McIntyre. I've got some involvement with Dylan Fletcher and Stu Bithell in the 49er. I'm coaching Nathan Outridge. I'm coaching Francesco Bruni, Chris Draper. I was thinking, God, that's pretty good development. You know, like, as in, I can learn a hell of a lot from all of these sailors, which is likely to make me a better coach and within the sailing world.
Was it a bit daunting taking all that on?
Yeah, it was. It was a bit daunting, but I really enjoy it. I really enjoy working with people that I know are better than me, as in I know they're better sailors than me, and they definitely know their boats better than me. But looking at finding ways for them to be better and finding ways for them to look at what they do and look at how it could be refined to be either at a higher level or just more consistent, something that they can deliver again and again and again.
You mentioned egos earlier, and no offence to Nathan, he's a lovely guy, but how much of a challenge is it coaching a team of A-list sailing talent?
You would think it would be quite a challenge, but I have to say, Team Japan in CLGP has been a real pleasure from that point of view. We have such good conversations. They're so quick to put their hand up and say, that was me, that was my mistake. And I think that is all about culture, and how do you create a culture within a team where the unacceptable thing to do is hide your mistakes. The acceptable thing to do is that you own up. It's not owning up. That's the wrong way to look at it. You recognize where you could be better, and the culture is that we do that and we progress. It's not a big deal. And I'm not saying that all comes from me at all, but I think Nathan's obviously the head of the team, and I think a lot of that comes from him. But in that boat, there is a very good culture. It's very easy to admit to a mistake, and it's very easy to say where you think you can do something better, which is great. It's not what you'd expect from an A-list boat, as you call it.
Do you miss racing yourself, Joe?
I hesitate to say no. Sometimes I do, but not a lot. I remember I did a bit of sailing recently, and I thought to myself, "Oh, this is just frustrating. I'm not doing enough to be as good as I'd like to be." Whilst the coaching, I feel like, okay, I do enough of this to be good at it, and so I almost get more pleasure of it. But it makes me realise what I loved about Olympic sailing. I still get that from the coaching, which is the project side of it. You've got a project, you know when you're trying to get to it. Well, unless they get delayed by a year. But and that's that. I always love that about Olympic sailing, and I still get that from the coaching as well.
Working to a deadline.
Yeah, exactly. Working to a deadline.
Joe Glanfield, thank you so much for talking to us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Our final interview from the world of high-performance sailing coaching comes from an unconventional source. And to set the scene, we need to go back to the Volvo Ocean Race of 2017-18. Finishing in The Hague after an entire lap of the planet, three different teams could have won. It was an epic affair. I can remember standing on a chase boat just a few miles from the finish, glued to a set of binoculars, looking for the first mast over the horizon. One of the boats I was looking for, one of the yachts in with a shout, was Bauer Becking's Team Brunel. If you'd have suggested they'd be in with a chance of the win halfway around, any expert would have laughed at you. They had a terrible first half to their lap of the planet. Becking was into his eighth edition of the race, the most by anyone. He had an experienced navigator in Andrew Cape and a crew brimming with talent. Pete Burling, Kyle Langford, Abby Ayler, Annie Lush. And onshore, they had a team member that Becking had since referred to as his secret weapon. Anja Maraki van Bokstel is an organisational psychologist. She specialises in the world of high-end business and finance, where she coaches in executive team development. And in the previous edition of the race, Becking brought her in to coach his Volvo Ocean Race team. Her fascinating application of the psychology of business leadership and team development to the world of offshore sailing revolutionised Becking's two campaigns. We interviewed Anja Maraki remotely, and in our interview several times, she references the phrase VUCA, a VUCA world. For those unfamiliar, this is the modern business world of constant change. VUCA standing for volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity. A state now considered the norm in certain areas of the business world. And four words very, very apt to life on board a Volvo Ocean Race yacht. Anja Maraki, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Last time I met you was at the Maritime Film Festival in Bilbao in Spain, just pre-pandemic. And I'll always remember two things about you. Firstly, how fascinating your take on working with teams was, but also how easily you got me to open up about my own deal. It's a talent. You're very easy to talk to. Have you always been, well, I guess, rather inquisitive?
I think I am. And thank you for the compliment, Shirley. I like meeting you so very much. Yes, I always was kind of interested in people and the systems they work and live in. And there's another thing. I kind of see potential and I love to help people reach for that. So both of them.
Do you find yourself in normal life just finding out about everyone's woes and dreams, everyone you meet?
Yes, I really like that because I think my basic values are about development, connection and fun. So there.
Well, before we get going, can you tell us what your involvement in sailing has been and what you're up to now?
Okay, so involvement in professional sailing is the Volvo Ocean Race 14, 15, 17, 18 with Team Brunel. I worked with 470 Olympic sailors in the Netherlands, and now I'm part of the 11th hour team for the Ocean Race.
I'm right, I think, in saying that you're a non-sailor. And if you are, you're the first non-sailor we've interviewed on the podcast. You might not know the ins and outs of leech tension or trimming angles, but you are revered for your coaching work with ocean-going race teams. How do you go from business coaching to working in a pretty extreme part of sailing?
Yeah, well, I think bottom line, boardroom teams and sailing teams, they both work in a VUCA world. So they both work in environments that are constantly changing, and they have to anticipate changing conditions and adjust to elements over which they have no control. So in both teams, it's about leadership and personal leadership and team development. And in both teams, it's about if you stop learning, you're sailing in the back of the fleet. So behind the profession, it's about people and people being part of systems and people and teams growing. So I love it.
How hard is it, you know, working in what can be a pretty technical sport, but not having done a lap of the planet yourself?
Yeah. Well, I have a huge respect for the technicality and the complexity and the intelligence you need to do big boat ocean sailing. And of course, when you start out in this branch, you have to dive in deep and being out there, sail with them, know what it takes to do sports like this. But I think for my profession, it's especially getting to know them. Getting to know the leaders and the personal leaders, help them to grow themselves and each other, to get the best out of themselves and the best out of each other.
All right, let's get into offshore sailing. I'm just starting to getting into it myself. Maybe we need a discussion later about that. It's hard. I mean, how much does that affect your approach, that you're not coaching people who go home at night to their loved ones? They're out in the wild seas for weeks on end. It's a stressful environment.
Yeah, it is. So for people who can go home in the evening, those people like me, we do have another life, another perspective that relativizes whatever happens during the day. So it gives us a second leg or even a third leg to walk on and charge our batteries. When you do sports like these, the only me time is between your own eyes. So it is more difficult. On the other hand, there's more to win for people in sailing teams. I think in boardroom teams or working teams, sometimes the own interest prevails above the team or organizational interest. And in sailing teams, you definitely need each other to perform and to reach for your own dreams and goals. So it is more difficult, but there's more to find there and to grow too. And what it makes more difficult is, and I think it's one of my roles to help them to reach for that utmost performance and getting to know each other and dive deep. Because when you are together as a team and you don't have a lot of other perspectives to blow off steam, sometimes we tend to motivated by avoiding conflicts, to sweep all the disagreements under the carpet. And when you do that, you're not growing a high-performance team. So I think that's the utmost challenge. But the nice thing is, with sports people, with top athletes, is they are reserved in the beginning, but the minute they find out you are there to help them and you really can help them in reaching for their dreams, they let you in quickly and they talk with you about almost everything. So it helps growing steep learning curves. I love it.
It's interesting that you talk about sort of avoiding conflict. And I guess I'm sort of thinking of my own scenarios. I remember, you know, sailing, we called it stamp collecting, actually, and you would just kind of take a deep breath and not say anything. And eventually you've collected enough stamps that something, you know, something has to happen. And then it's terminal, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you know what is, from a psychological perspective, because this is understandable, isn't it? But it doesn't help you to grow yourself and grow the team. Because nowadays, in a difficult game as ocean sailing is, As an individual leader or the skipper, you are not enough anymore to gather all the data and analyze them and make the right calls. We need all the perspectives from this diverse crew. And it's extremely difficult to work with diversity. It is kind of easy to sweep all the differences under the carpet. But it is stupid because it doesn't make you agile, it doesn't make you creative and innovative, and it doesn't help you to reach for results. So to make use of all this, well, it's not even demographic diversity, because what the demographic diversity brings is cognitive diversity and experiential diversity, and it helps us to reach for new perspectives and better solutions. But all of us, when you've got a brain, you've got a bias, all of us prefer to sail around the world with a team of clones. So it's helpful to help us and each other to work in a team with a lot of diversity, bring all those perspectives to the table and make them work, because you learn to collaborate and to reach for the same big dream.
I love that. I don't think a team of Shirley Robertsons would get around the world.
Never say never, Shirley.
You know, winning in business is not as clear cut as on the racetrack, is it? I mean, how hard is it dealing with losses and defeat? How do you deal with that coaching-wise?
Well, you know, I think it's easy to be a team when you're winning, but a real team pops up when you lose a game or even lose colleagues. And how you deal with it is, well, you can do some preparations, can't you? So when you do have the time working with the team before they go racing and before stuff goes wrong, you can help each and everybody to create their own compass, to navigate in life and navigate the situations that you peak and navigate the situations that it is really hard, and get all those individual compasses together into creating a team compass, a team identity, a team culture, and work with how are you a team when everything is going great, and how do you want to be a team when it's going to get tough. And when you work with the team, you have a lot of possibilities to train that small things that go wrong and small disappointments. And so the crew has something to fall back on when something really goes wrong.
I don't want to upset anyone here, but it's a tough world to compete in. There are people in offshore sailing with a huge amount of responsibility, the safety of the crew, the tactical decisions. And so the sport tends to attract, how shall I say this, some strong personalities. How hard is it to coach in an environment where, I guess, being an alpha male is sometimes a prerequisite?
Well, how hard is it? I think most of the boardrooms of large corporates, it looks kind of like the same. Alpha males, alpha females. It is the system that grew in this way, isn't it? And nowadays, a lot of skippers and alpha people, they kind of realize that it is necessary to, when you want to, your crew members to be your eyes and ears and brains, you have to find yourself a way of leading them that gets all those perspectives we were talking about to the table. So I love to work in environments in which people take on such a lot of responsibility, and that they sometimes, or more than sometimes, display a kind of dominant leadership style. It's most of the time coming from a good heart. And on the other perspective, I met teams who say this skipper takes on the responsibility to drag 8 or 9 lives across the ocean. So it is both the leaders and the personal leaders' responsibility to create them a team culture in which each and every one thrives. So to be really honest, when you want to win or to reach results, you need to grow your leadership style. And to be really honest, skippers and teams only hire me when they want to grow their team culture and their personal leadership and their leadership style. So there's a lot to win, I think, from performance perspective. And nowadays, people kind of know they have to grow, because when you stop learning, you are in the back of the fleet. And I always say it's all about learning and growing, not about ego and knowing. And in the VUCA world, we kind of get that.
Be honest with me. When you first rocked up in the Volvo Ocean Race world, what did you make of it all?
Well, Bauer gave me this brilliant plan. He said, just work with the guys, don't have an opinion, and if you do have one, don't share it. So that's how I started. Just working on the boats, helping them to get it ready. And what I learned is I have a huge respect for people working in such a complex, challenging world. And on the other hand, surely I found out that in ocean sailing, leaders are more humble than normal leaders in big corporates are. Because after all, when you're on the ocean, you are really small in the big nature. So I met a lot of really nice people and people who knew that they need each other to perform. So it was challenging, and I met a lot of big, great, nice people who want to develop and make big steps in collaboration and team dynamics, because they need each other. You can't do it on your own. And when I think back of those times, I think that stood out. Yeah.
In the case of Brunel, as you say, Bauer Becking brought you in to coach the team. And he's a man that sailed more Volvo Ocean Races than any other sailor. And he referred to you as the team's secret weapon. Why? Give us a glimpse into what you were doing to help the team. How did you operate? What did you bring to Brunel?
Oh, yeah, well, okay. I think the secret weapon is also because being a team coach, a mental coach, let alone a psychologist, let alone a woman in those days, was kind of new. So maybe that's a secret thing. And what I liked Bauer saying when I started out is normally he said, you're only as good as your last result. But he added a sentence to it when we worked for several months. And he said, when I stop learning, I have to find myself another profession. And I think that kind of creates a space in which it's normal to learn and to grow. So what I did is kind of squeeze in a natural way and getting to know those people and help them to get to know each other and help them create a team identity, a way of being and working together in which they got the best out of themselves and got the best out of each other. And as we started out, or when we started out, what normally happens in teams when leaders hire you is they kind of think they can delegate the leadership, the human part of leadership to the coach, and you simply can't. It is taking on responsibility, but finding a way how to do that. For leaders and personal leaders, for skippers and crew members to get on the table what you need to flourish and to perform and to grow, and what stops you. And so I think it's there.
Quite brave of Bauer, quite forward thinking to sort of appreciate that he needed help with the human element of bringing the package together.
I think so. And quite brave to talk about it in public, wasn't it? Because you see, I'm working in this branch for quite some time. And when I started out coaching and training leaders, it was very unusual to talk about that you got help and you had talks about your leadership and individual development and to bring it out in the open also in the media. I think it's brave. And it sets an example, because if we stop learning, well, we maybe do have to find ourselves another profession. Because it's also nice to learn and grow and help other people to reach for their potential, isn't it? So, yeah.
In the last edition of the Volvo, they had a terrible first half of the race, but won two double point legs, and by the last leg were in serious contention for the win. What do you attribute that turnaround to? And also, you know, how bad was it halfway around the planet? Describe what it was like within that team.
Well, I think all of us know it was pretty bad. Okay, when they came in Auckland halfway the race and they were lost all over. People were this frustrated and disappointed, mad, sad. They lost trust in themselves and each other. They even started blaming and shaming, like all of us would do when we are really disappointed. But we had 2 weeks in Auckland, so we were able to turn it around. And well, what we kind of did, we talked about it already, it is getting out there. What do you need to get the best out of yourself? What do you need from your leader? What do you need from your colleagues? And what stops you from being effective? And to share that. And I started out having those talks with all the crew members, and then obviously talked with the skipper. And he put up his hands and said what he heard he should change and called them forth for what he needed to be effective. And we created ourselves, or they created themselves, a new designed alliance, a compass to sail on, and it helped enormously. But you know what happens? Most of us as human beings, we tend to stay within our comfort zone, especially when the going gets tough and it doesn't work out. We tend to reach for stuff we knew, to talk about roles and tactics and technicalities, and it is difficult to get out of our comfort zones and talk about behaviors and what doesn't go well in relationships and team dynamics. It's difficult. We have to get out of our comfort zones, into our fear zones, before we get into our learning and growth zones. So I think it happens to all of us. And when the urgency is still here, when it is really important, because you're down there as an individual or a team, we tend to step out of our comfort zones easier. And I think the nice thing of 11th hour hiring me now, way before the ocean race, is that we do have some time to work with the sailing crew and the shore crew and the technical crew and all of the, and families and friends, all of those wonderful people who together are this campaign. And create a lot of this stuff before we go racing.
Yeah, time's a luxury. Let's go back to Team Brunel. And the team looked, from the outside at least, to be a tricky makeup of characters. Bauer, the most experienced of all the skippers, Andrew Cape, Capey, a very experienced navigator who's renowned for, let's just say, his quiet nature. He doesn't say a lot. And a bunch of young talent, most notably Peter Berling, hot from an America's Cup win and an Olympic gold. I mean, from the outside, a team bursting with talent, but also a lot of men used to pointing a boat where they want to point a boat. How tricky was that dynamic?
Okay, well, it was tricky. And that's not because of the demographic diversity, like age and gender and but it is and nationality and whatever, but there was a lot of cognitive diversity, like thinking styles and knowledge and experiential cognitive diversity, like behavioral patterns. And well, you just mentioned it, and it is difficult to work in a diverse setting like this. So, and because we really started out late to race, so it was about designing ourselves a way of collaboration and learning from each other. And what we saw is after Auckland is finding words and being brutal with ourselves, like Abby liked to put it, is find ourselves a way to bring it out there and to talk about it and to trust each other because we sailed for some legs, to be safe and be fast. So on the one hand, it's time. On the other hand, it's trust. But what I think what I bring to the team is try it out, find yourself words for it, and speak up and be open from every perspective. It's important. And hold each other accountable for living those team values and calling each other forth for effective behaviors, but also for ineffective behaviors. And when you do that, learning curves do grow steep. And as steep as they did in the second half of the race, I think the whole team was extremely proud of themselves, but especially of each other.
It was an amazing comeback. We were in The Hague looking through binoculars at three boats that could have won, and one of them, Brunel. It was an incredible, incredible story. What about for you personally? You know, how special a moment was that, seeing them turning into, you know, a winning outfit?
Yeah, well, it was, I think the best moment is when they got into Gothenburg and they had a shared first place and a possibility to win the race after such a challenging half a year. I was really proud and really connected. And yeah, and it was, I loved their courage for getting out of their comfort zones and reaching this far to really get themselves and get each other for the best possible way of working. My heart sank in The Hague, in Scheveningen, for the last leg, because they wanted to win so badly and I would love them to win too, but because it was there and I think they also deserved it, didn't they? And it would have been the best of a story. And in the same time, like you say, nobody will ever forget what they did and what they learned and how they were able to turn the learning curve around. So, but I would have loved them to win, definitely.
It's hard for the fairy tale to happen. It's a big ask, isn't it? Anja Maricki, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Shirley.
Anja Maricki, wrapping up for fascinating interviews from this month's podcast. Where would we be without the patience and dedication of such talented coaches? To Joe and Anja Maricki, thank you so much for your time. Well, you know we love to hear from you, so let me know what you think, like, review and subscribe on whatever platform you join us on. And go on, buy us a coffee if you've enjoyed the pod. It's easy. buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. Helping us bring you uninterrupted, ad-free chat from the leading lights in the sport of sailing.
A massive thanks to Tim at Vertigo Films for editing and producing each one of these podcasts with love and care. A big thank you, Tim. Please keep in touch via social media. I'm Shirley Sale on Instagram and Twitter, Shirley Robertson on Facebook, and it's always so great to hear from you. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race off speaking.
Layout is on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
We're a bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the layout there. Gaining on the layout.
We're looking at 10.5.42. Matching him on the boundary, Jeff. Copy.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.